It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And today's conversation is about plastics. And when we think of plastic, we tend to think of bags and straws. And our guest, Calliope Munoz, is an environmental artist who really uses plastic in a way to help us not only see the positives, but to see how its presence in our lives. And so we find it covering our walls. It wraps our buildings. It corrects our vision, fills our cavities. All these came from Cappy's work on her website. So glad to have you, Cappy.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So just so that we can get our listeners a little oriented, you have a really diverse background, which is what I love, and this show's about art and science. So can you tell people a little bit about yourself first?
Sure. I never envisioned myself as an artist. I never would have guessed I would have been here as a kid. Actually, I wanted to be a prehistoric paleoanthropologist is what I used to tell people. So I followed the science path, and when I realized how few hominid fossils there were to go on, I thought, I need a little more meat to sink my teeth into. So I gradually transitioned I was a geology major. I was interested in paleontology, but I started my career as a science illustrator for Neil Shubin at the University of Chicago. And it was a really wonderful way to combine art and science. I really hadn't anticipated that those two things could coexist so beautifully in a career. But when I found it, I knew that that was what I wanted to do. It satisfied my need for science and being on the front edge of knowledge, of human knowledge, which is absolutely terrifying and wonderful. but it also brought in what I loved to do when I went home, which was take art classes and create. And so it was this wonderful marriage of those two pursuits. And very slowly over the decade that I was in Neil Shubin's lab, I started to expand my outreach. So scientific illustration is at least in its history, was a very straightforward field. Were the eyes for scientists, and you drew their specimens, you described their finds for mostly the scientific community. You know, of course, before there were cameras and widespread imagery, you were showing the world what was out there through your illustrations. And as science got more and more sophisticated, those drawings became more and more esoteric and less accessible to the public. And so science illustration in the last kind of two to three decades, I would say, has gone through this transformation where now science illustrators really view themselves as a bridge from the science world to the public, and it can take on so many more different media. It can exist in different environments, like you beautifully say that your Da Vinci Pursuit is a museum without walls. You know, science illustration is science education outside of the classroom, and so that's kind of what I learned in that decade that I was working with Neil Shubin, as I created illustrations for talks that he gave at schools, for talks that he gave in libraries, universities, to the general public through bookstores. And then, of course, he wrote a couple of best-selling nonfiction books that I had the pleasure of illustrating. And that even brought this idea more to the fore, that science illustrators can actually have a hand in bringing these really intense science concepts and the front line of scientific knowledge into the public sphere. So that's kind of how I began to gradually shift into doing my own work about topics that I was really interested in and bringing them to the public in a way that's completely accessible and non-intimidating through art.
You know, that's really a really wonderful story, because that journey, not only was it you as a personal journey, but you're also chronicling what was happening in the profession of science illustration. And I don't think people realize, you know, we've kind of gone back in certain way to, you remember the early naturalists did illustration because they didn't have a camera and they didn't have a way of even communicating it necessarily in words. So they had to be pretty sophisticated at learning to draw. So most naturalists had to draw. And then it became more later, like you said, that scientists needed illustrators to draw something that they, a specimen or an object or something that they had, or museums needed it to be illustrated for in a collection. And then now we've like full circle a little bit, except we add education to it, right? So now we're back to helping, I think, isn't it helping us, the art helps us see the science?
That's right.
Would that be right?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, there are a number of efforts to bring drawing back to science curricula for that exact reason. Because when you stare at an object for 18 hours to complete an illustration, you see stuff that you wouldn't have seen when you look at it for 30 seconds, which is what most of us do. Most of us look at an object, we understand it conceptually. Oh, that's a bone. Done. We've classified it in our brain. We move on. But what drawing forces you to do is to ditch the conception that, or the crutch, I would call it a crutch, that our brain constructs, like, that's a bone. I know what a bone looks like. It's long and skinny, it has a bump on the end. And it forces you to actually say, okay, well, what does a bump on the end look like? And, you know, what it actually is, maybe so long and skinny, or, you know, all these stereotypes that we use to get through the world so that we're not like a 2-year-old walking down the sidewalk and watching every single ant to see where it goes, if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. And I would assume it also helps you to ask questions, because
yes,
not only are you looking at bone, but, you know, I could say, oh, there's a bump on it. However, if you're drawing it for a long time, you're probably sitting there wondering, well, what does the bump, why is it there? You know, because nature didn't just create these things just, you know, willy-nilly. There must have been something that was either attached or it gave it some advantage to be like that.
Yes. And there's so many examples. And it's so interesting that you say that art and drawing is a tool to see better, because you see, there's so many examples of artists who are working for paleontologists who see stuff on the bones and ask about it. What was this for? And it's something that the scientists had not seen before. And it happens all the time. And it's interesting, because it just underscores your point about how, you know, it's a tool for seeing better, for looking more closely, for observing. And when that split happened in the science community, where naturalists were no longer, scientists were so specialized that they didn't have time to learn to draw, or they didn't emphasize that was important. Maybe they lost an ability to see a little bit. Thank goodness they teamed up with people who love to draw. So yeah, it kind of goes in line with the interdisciplinary trends in research and education now, where even in boardrooms, right? The more diverse people that you have in a room, the better the outcomes always. So,
that's really interesting. And, you know, a couple of my board members for the Da Vinci Pursuit are really heavily involved in science, but both of them have really started to say that they're frustrated because a lot of new scientists coming into the field are not seeing anymore. Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting description, because it means that they go through things almost in a verbal way, or they have them as photographs. But again, they're not noticing the things that an artist could notice. And I think it's maybe, while a scientist being the artist is there, but also an artist who knows a little bit about that field, but also is illustrating, might see things that are, you know, that the scientists wouldn't see. And so I like this idea, you know, where we might be going with science illustration could be to more collaboration in the research end, where artists are not just giving us the illustration of something, but are also suggesting new areas of research.
Absolutely. And that is one of my favorite stories from my time as an illustrator. Was I was working with a postdoc. No, I'm sorry. She was a graduate student at the University of Chicago in another lab adjacent to Neil's. And she worked with lungfish, and she had them walking on, or well, they have these whip-like fins, and she had them walking. She was analyzing how they walked and moved, and she asked me to create a still image for the paper that she was writing because she couldn't include the videos. Those had to be supplementary materials. And so I had so much fun. I broke it down frame by frame, and I, you know, did this really cool looking overlapping illustration of shadows of the lungfish walking. And what you could see when you distilled it down in that way was there were these pivot points where the whip fin hit the base plate and pushed off. And I asked her about it. I was like, have you ever noticed like that? That's where its footprints are, you know, and does it make marks in the sand when it walks through sand? And it opened up this whole line of research for her. She hadn't even thought of doing, I guess in biomechanics, they do like pressure plates to see the force with which an animal moves. Anyway, she was like, I hadn't even thought about how I could adapt the experiment that way. But now that I see it in front of me in this diagram you made, I want to try it. And so that was really rewarding. And it perfectly illustrates how you can have these interactions where just somebody who looks at it differently can come in and ask a question that sparks a whole new area of research and inquiry.
Yeah. And what you're saying, and I think it's really important on the education side of this, is that we really speak languages. You know, artists do, you know, there's different languages depending on the art form you're in. There's different languages for science. And often those languages we don't, even when we're in the profession, necessarily understand, but we have this problem where I think we should, because we're an expert, right? So we kind of nod and go along, and, you know, somebody says, oh, yeah. And so what I'm finding with some of the research I've been doing is that even in the science field, a lot of people will go to a conference to listen to a really top scientist in their field. They'll listen to them, and they have a ton of questions, and they won't ask them because they're embarrassed to say it. So what you're talking about really is not just the public being educated, but honestly, people being more honest that I don't know something. It's okay if we ask something.
Yeah, definitely. I think that was the most fruitful part of my relationship in the Shubin Lab, was that I never felt like the expert, but I felt respected and smart enough that if I had a question, I was going to ask it. No one was going to laugh. They're like, that's a great question. I love that you asked that. And that that kind of work environment really does, yeah, as you say, bring out the best and allow for, I mean, like the scientists at conferences, they're smart people. That's not their specialty. That, you know, the talk that they're listening to is not their specialty. So there's no shame in having 100 questions.
And it's so funny. And we also, I've talked about this before, but we also stagger the conference in a stilted kind of way. So every conference I go to, usually that's a science conference, but even outside of it, there's a keynote speaker, Then there's a panel. And then finally, we get to some questions in the audience, if we have time. And everybody's tired and bored by the time we get there. And it's really not, we need something to spark us. So the keynote makes sense, but the panel could go away. And so it's, you know, we don't need other people talking about that or other experts about it, because now I've listened and I have these questions. One last thing on this whole idea of illustrating, and I use it all the time. As you know, I take people on nature walks, and so that they can see in an urban setting, the nature that's around them in the natural world. And often I'll be out, and it wasn't too long ago, I always have a sketch pad with me and a pencil. And somebody was asking me something about how a bird could do what it does with it. This particular bird could do something with its wing. And I found myself drawing to illustrate it, that you know, how it hooks. And so yeah, with the feathers, you know, there's a hook and there's a, you know, it's like Velcro. And I said, well, you know, it just zips up on there, because they see it open when it's preening and cleaning it and doing that. But then it all locks itself back for flight. But I had no way of, I can describe it here even with this, but I wish I had a way of drawing those little hooks, right?
Yeah.
And once I did that, immediately people got it.
Yeah, interesting.
So again, I'm back to what you're talking about. Sometimes there is no better thing than a drawing.
Yeah, definitely.
And just a little sketch real quick here to explain something. Mm-hmm. And again, when we moved, you know, into conferences and learning, we move a right way to PowerPoints and stuff. But I would love it if we had more people that could actually draw on the screen, you know, or at least have somebody beside, like an illustrator who is doing that, not just capturing what's going on, but illustrating pieces of it. Mm-hmm. So this all makes perfect sense. And we've been talking about how you got to where you are, but now there's this leap, and you alluded to it, that illustration moves beyond the illustration of just 2D and can move into a 3D world, right? With objects, and you can use objects to create art, to illustrate something. Mm-hmm. And that's where you are with plastics, right? You've moved kind of into that area. So tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I've always been environmentally minded and concerned about my footprint and taking up a space in the world. And so when I decided to go freelance, I, you know, spent a lot of time kind of just exploring different avenues of thought that would be compelling. And the plastics thread was really, really felt timely. The news about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch was coming to the fore, and gosh, what else was happening at the time? That's hard to remember back that far.
I understand.
But anyway, I mean, I listened to actually a really interesting interview just a couple of days ago. Do you ever listen to the Ezra Klein podcast?
Yeah,
he's fantastic. And he is interviewing a poet, of all things. And she said something really compelling, which crystallizes what I've been working on in my work. And that is that nobody's going to save the world because it's a good idea, or the planet because it's a good idea. They're going to do it because they love this planet, and it's the only one we have. And I thought, yep, that's exactly where I am. And so to bring it back to plastics, you know, I was really intrigued by how much we use, how problematic it is in the environment once we're done with it. Gosh, there's so many ideas going in my head. I can't really pick which one is the most important to emphasize.
That's okay.
But what I love about it is that we're all participating in this system. And I think that a lot of the environmental messages that are strident get tuned out pretty quickly. You know, that's a little bit funny to say, because they've worked on me. Like, I'm hook, line, and sinker. Let's do what we can to save the earth. On the other hand, I drive a car. I fly places. I eat food that has traveled sometimes across oceans to get to me, right? I certainly buy clothes that have traveled across oceans to get to me. You know, there are all of these things that make modern life really convenient and comfortable and even healthier that I participate in. And yet, I'm sad when I go to the beach and I see all this plastic, you know, detritus lying around. And that's the product of me living my life. And it's so that I think is a more interesting angle to take than the typical environmental messages, which are like guilt inducing, right? Yeah, it is really stinky that we produce all this stuff, but it's not a point fingers game because we could just as easily point it back at us, right? We are Americans living the, you know, American consumerist dream. And it's pretty nice.
It is. And, you know, it's what you're saying is it's really important to understand that where we've gotten to is a wonderful place. Our technology, our industrialization, all that has helped. However, once we start to understand how it can be a problem too, if we keep doing it after that, then, and without, you know, without doing something to change it, then we are part of the problem. And so, you know, I don't like to go back necessarily and find somebody and say, point the finger, like you said, pointing back, oh, you terrible people for finding fossil fuels and, you know, mm-hmm. or inventing plastics. But if you are still not convinced that we need to be changing the way in which we do it, then that becomes, I think, our big problem. And that's what you're saying. So this has inspired you then to use plastics itself as an art form. And so how did you even come up with the idea that you were going to turn it into something artistic?
Actually, the first idea I had was illustrative. I got a compost, a citywide compost bin, and that allows you to put any organic food waste, including bones, including, you know, grains, things that you wouldn't be able to put in a home composting system, into the city compost. And what was left in our trash was just plastic packaging. And I thought, this is incredible. Like, first of all, the garbage never stinks anymore. Yay. But holy cow, we use so much plastic packaging. Yeah. And I wanted to show people. And so I had young kids at the time, and I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun if we, oh, well, first, I guess I thought, you know, this is not an impressive amount by weight, nor is it an impressive amount by volume, but by area, because it was all thin plastic film, that would be interesting. And I thought, could we cover the schoolyard? Right. With a year's worth of plastic, or, you know, what are the kids producing during lunch in their, with their snacks? If you've ever had young kids, you know, like, the snacks, the single use, you know,
right. Go into grocery size. Store and you see millions of them.
Yeah. Yeah. The juice boxes, the,
right.
So that was the first, idea I had. And just to create a big flat piece, I thought, I wonder if I could sew this together. And so I did a test piece in my studio, and sure enough, it sewed. And I thought, man, this is cool. And then I started looking at the amazing colors that they use in marketing. And the very next natural step was quilts. And I love the concept of that, because quilts were always made from the scraps of our lives. When we were making clothes, when rice and beans came in cloth bags, you used that fabric because fabric was expensive. And when clothes wore out, right, you used it again, because it's expensive. So I thought, gosh, this is incredible. This material is still perfectly good. This plastic material that we're throwing away is still perfectly good. It sews well, and it makes a robust, quilt. Like, let me show people that. Let me show how wasteful our society is at the moment by creating these things that could be heirlooms if only we switched the way we looked at them. So that was the beginning. And then I just went from there, because we produce so much waste. It's so much more than food bags. And the materials are interesting and beautiful if you transform them. If you can get people to look at them and forget that they're a bag, people can remember, like, it's kind of like you can trigger the, whoa, that's, what is that again? Right? Because plastic is so ubiquitous, we've become numb to it. We don't even look, we don't even think about what it could be. We just think like, that's a Ziploc bag. Whoop-de-doo. Use it for your cold cuts and then throw it away.
Right. I mean, we're full circle again, because what we were talking about earlier was, using art as a way of seeing, and that's what you're saying. So
exactly.
When something, and we all, I think, particularly humans, have this thing where if we have it repetitively in our lives, right, we begin to not see it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Even patterns we begin to not see in relationships or whatever. And sometimes that's why we'll go to a counselor, or we'll do whatever is for somebody to point out, you're not seeing something that's really obvious. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's, so I get what you're doing. I get that you're using that material itself as a way of getting us to see it again. And maybe seeing it anew, the way you're saying, seeing it as beauty or seeing it as a quilt, maybe it calls it out in a way that if it was just, oh, here's a pile of plastic, right?
Right.
We see those all the time where somebody's trying to preach at us, but I don't think that has as much an effect as what you just did, which is, wow, that's beautiful. And look at how that went together and how they do that. And then all of a sudden, but oh my God, it's plastic. Right.
Yeah.
Where did all this come from? So
yeah.
That first one you did was right. That big one, the quilt that you did. How long did you collect?
Which one? Cause I've done quite a few.
Yeah. You did.
Very first one. The one that we were talking about.
First one. Yeah.
Yeah. So that actually never came to fruition. I wanted to have it like wrap the school bus or something. And we weren't able to coordinate to make that happen. But I did then make a big 10 and a half foot by 5 and a half foot quilt, based actually off of a design that I come from a family of quilters. So every time I go to my mom's house, there's like another quilt that I haven't seen that she's pulled out from the archives.
Yeah.
And so this happened and I was like, that is the coolest pattern. And my aunt who made it is by trade, she was a museum conservator. So of course she had the pattern lying around in her house, and she sent it to me and I adapted it to make this really big quilt that I call Drops in the Ocean. Cause it was these squiggly lines, which I turned into concentric circles, and I had them busting out of, a traditional quilt would be like a 9x9 grid or something. And I had them kind of breaking out of that grid and expanding to show how plastic, we think we have a handle on it. It's something we manufacture. It's something that we have quote unquote control over. And yet we, it's kind of busting out of the confines that we've created for it, and threatening us. So yeah, that was the first kind of
tentacle.
Massive one. Yeah, that I made. I guess there was a previous installation I did before that. There was a previous installation I did before that that I called Cascade, which was my first big plastic installation. And that one was 18 feet long. It started at the top of the gallery wall as just a pinpoint. And then it came down and widened and widened and widened until it spilled out onto the gallery floor, and where, people could kind of walk around it. And that was a really fun one because it ended in, so it was quilted. It was pretty. until the very end. And then it turned into kind of just bags, like just junky. And
that's great.
It was really fun. It was really fun. That one I loved because in the opening night, there was this couple that was looking at it, and it was in a bit of a nook. So there was one other piece of artwork next to it. And my piece came out about 9 feet into the gallery room floor. And the husband and wife, they were standing at the end of it, kind of with their toes at the end of the bags. And then the wife finished looking at it, and she just walked across the bottom of the piece. And her husband said, "You can't do that. You can't walk on the art." And she goes, "It's not art. It's trash." And I was like, I can't believe I witnessed that interaction, because that was exact. I was like, yes, I want to give you a trophy. You're right. It's right. Both of those things.
Yeah, you intended it to be down there for that reason.
It was amazing. I was like, she got it. She got it.
That's a wonderful story. And we're talking with our guest, Calliope Maños, who's an environmental artist that works in plastic. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with our guest who explores the world of plastic in her art while balancing the toll of the environment with the versatility of plastics. And in this segment, we're going to explore an upcoming entry that she has into a Chicago runway. And get this, I have to get it right, Trashon, not fashion, Trashon show, where Cappy is going to create a fashion from trashed plastics. Okay, I can hardly wait. A runway show out of plastic things. So first of all, have they been doing this for a while, or is this something new?
So Trashon shows are not new, okay. but this particular one is new, and it's a brainchild of the Treveni Institute, which is a nonprofit in Chicago that's trying to reduce single-use plastic waste. And this Trashon show is, I think, up to 30 designers now who are creating looks out of single-use plastic. And they're going to be very, she called it, I think it's funny, she's called it like part opera, part runway show. You know, she's calling it high trash art, which is good because that's what I do. but yeah, so I had been thinking for a while about this idea of out of sight, out of mind, and how our garbage production has increased steadily per capita since garbage collection became a thing. And that makes sense, because if you have to live with it, you start to think a little bit more creatively about how to reuse it. Maybe you choose the items that you bring into your life more carefully. And so I was thinking just on my own about if we had to carry around all of the plastic waste that we produce, what would that look like, right? And so the natural conclusion there is that I have to make wearables. And so I was working on wearables. And then I heard about this opportunity in Chicago, and I was like, okay, I'm in. So I contacted the founder, Jordan Parker, and she was really great and invited me into the show.
Wow, 30 artists?
30 artists, yeah.
Trash artists.
I mean, yeah, you know, not all of them do this all the time,
right?
But all of them are sustainability minded and yeah. So I'm super excited.
Did you do sketches like a fashion artist would do of what you were going to wear?
Well, I'm not wearing it.
Oh, it goes on to a model.
It goes on a real model. Yeah, they hired real models.
Oh, this is really even better. So, okay.
Yeah.
So it's just like a real runway show or somebody's wearing your work.
Totally.
You have to create more than one piece?
No, it's one piece per.
Okay, so not a collection. Thank goodness.
although, I mean, that's what I'm going to work on next. I mean, that's my kind of next line of inquiry. Yeah, it is how can I love this idea of taking time-based consumption, like snapshots of consumption over a period of time. And so, for example, we may have talked about this before, but I did a year of plastic. I collected a year of plastic from a friend and made a quilt that was 26 feet wide by 26 feet long. And that was really impressive. And it really resonates with people to have that time-based element. And so I want to keep doing that. And so, you know, for this trash and show, I'm creating a quilted jacket out of single-use plastic and then a floss kind of dental floss dress.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And then with fishnet stockings. From the like avocado and tangerine bags.
Fishnets.
No, from avocado and tangerine
bags. Oh, like the bag, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the red.
Yeah, open. Yeah, mesh. So air goes through it. Yeah.
Yeah, onion bags, that kind of thing.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that's what I'm creating for this, but that's not time based. I want eventually my next kind of project, I guess, is to one of the main critiques I've gotten, it's not a critique, but just an observation of the quilts that I make is, and you know, especially with this year of plastic, that's just the flat plastic, the sewable plastic that we throw out. It doesn't even approach what's in the recycling bin. And by the way, if you haven't heard already, I'm sure you have, but you know, most recycling that we throw away gets trashed. It's just not economical. And it depends on where you live and it depends on who your recycling company is, et cetera, et cetera. There are all these conditions, but most of it just doesn't get recycled. And it's not a high value product when it does get recycled. So it's just not the answer to our plastic woes. So I really want to take all of the plastic waste from my recycling bin for an amount of time and make, like, for example, a puffy jacket or I don't know, other weird, wonderful wearables that capture a month or a year, or, you know, I kind of have to see how much plastic we actually produce. But
you know, you're getting my you know, you're getting my creative brain going. You know, I'm imagining a time-based thing where you do it. All the plastics that were used for Halloween candy.
Oh, I already did that. actually, that's funny that you mentioned that. I forgot. You're like digging into the recesses of my past brain. That was the very first plastic quilt I did make. I took, because we get an obscene amount of candy. I mean, so much more that I got as a kid. It's not even comprehensible. I don't understand it. Anyway, actually I do. It's called economics and they sell us more every year. So anyway, but I did, the first thing I did was when I learned that I could sew this stuff, I was like, what does one of these Halloween baskets look like? And I made a quilt that I called We Heart Our Troops, because a lot of this gets sent over to our troops. And I was like, I don't know about you, but like, I love our troops, but do they really need this junk? Like, this is like the worst junk we could possibly send them. You know, I'm sure they're psyched to have a little taste of home, but like, do they need 800 pounds of it? Right. Like, is that really good for them? Anyway, and
wherever they are, do they need that much plastic?
Yeah. And that's another one too. But that's an interesting point. Plastic is the great equalizer. There is not a country on earth that doesn't use plastic copiously and problematically. And that's actually another thing that I think is really interesting. When I was working in academia, I felt very cloistered in academia, talking to people who looked like me, people who came from backgrounds like me. And when I entered into the plastic world, I was like, holy cow, this is cool. Everyone from the people who experiencing homelessness on the streets in my city to Jeff Bezos use plastic, everyone in between, you know, and multiply that around the world to every single country. I mean, it's an amazing equalizer, leveler. Is everybody's problem. So I like that.
I do too. That's really thrilling. So when I'm thinking about back to the Trishan show, does everything, the shoes, everything that that person wears have to be made out of plastic?
Yeah, I should look at the criteria. Yeah, no, it's not every single thing. I think she made it like 85 or 90% of the look has to be single use plastic, but there are some elements to hold it together that don't have to be single use, or, well, I guess single use, but they don't have to be trash. But she doesn't want you like going out and buying solo cups for this project. Like, they have to be used and collected.
Right, you don't want to contribute to the problem by buying it, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what she said. We're not voting with our dollars. She did make one exception for dental floss and other things that.
Yeah, you probably don't want to recycle sanitary. That. No, I get that one. Yeah, that's a really big problem.
Yeah, so my model will not be using. Will not be wearing used floss. That is also, I would say, the number one question I get. I make these dental floss embroideries.
Yeah.
And people are always like, wait, is that used? I'm like, no.
It's been sterilized.
Yeah. I boil it. It's fine.
It's all clean. just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersection between art and science. And we encourage you at home to explore further in conversation with others any of the ideas that we're exploring in today's show. And we'll be right back.
This is Jürgen Jungbauer from the Heidelberg House on Pendleton Pike here in Indianapolis. Join me this Sunday for German Music Hour. And even if you don't speak the language, I hope you enjoy the music and the rhythm and the beat on this radio station every Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's only here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about plastics, their reuse, the kinds of plastic that are the most artistically intriguing, and what you need to know about them to work with them. And that's where I want to go with this. So I have, we wanted to make a giant water bottle, a huge one, out of water bottles ourselves to float in the river. So I got an artist and contracted with him, and he got out of the trash, 1,500 1-liter bottles that were reused. And we were going to sculpt it by gluing it together and making it into a giant bottle, right? And then that would be at a festival, and then people could see, just like you're doing, that there was this thing. And so when we got into it, he couldn't get any glue to keep them together. In fact, what he ended up doing was getting this highly toxic glue that, not for the environment, but for him, he had to wear a respirator and all that to hold this stuff together. And then even that didn't exactly work, and we had to put a mesh around the outside. So it showed how difficult sometimes it is with the chemistry of plastics to work with it. What have you run into that's really, really tricky on trying to work with making, for instance, a dress even, or a jacket out of plastic?
Well, I'll just say, I bet there was toluene in that glue.
there was, like, and it was huge, really, really scary.
Yeah. So, for that reason, and also just my interests, I stick to mechanical methods. So sewing,
that helps.
Folding, origami, weaving, basketry techniques. Those, I'm trying to think if there's anything else I've done. Embroidery. And I like that conceptually too, because if you think about it, what I'm doing is I'm taking underused, overlooked materials that people, as you say, have become blind to. And I'm using these techniques that also have slipped in importance in our society. And yet, so like sewing, it's like typically women's work, right? Sewing, weaving, embroidery, all these things that have carried society for millennia, right? And now because of industrial manufacturing, like, it's like, oh, it's quaint. You do quilts? Oh, that's nice. You must be a grandma, you know, like, there's so much in that. Let's unpack that. You know, why don't we value these things anymore? Why don't we value slow work? Why don't we value frugality? Why don't we value unpaid work that's often done by women? These are questions that really resonate with me as a woman, as a mother, as a caretaker, you know, all of these things. They're bigger societal questions. And so I loved, you know, putting this into my work and choosing those very intentionally, choosing those techniques very intentionally. It just adds layers of depth. So I avoid heat. There are lots of people who like to see like what happens if they melt plastic together. I'm like, no, thanks. You know, cancer might kill me, but not cancer from my studio.
Right. And you're going to be releasing it in the environment no matter what. And that's the problem too. So,
yeah, well, that's an interesting question. I mean, literally the fate of all plastic is it will eventually make its way into the environment in the form of micro and nanoplastics and be problematic. That's just, you know, so this is an interesting fact. In 2021, we, as a global economy, like the entire world, produced 390 million metric tons of new plastic. And we do that plus 4% every single year. So recycling numbers around 8%. And we know that you can only recycle plastic a couple of times. There's like not a very valuable product when they recycle it. So recycling is not the answer. And we're just filling the bathtub. Did you ever read, oh gosh, this is really obscure. But there's this kid's book by Arnold Lobel, who's the author of the Frog and Toad series. Mm-hmm. But he had this one that's very much less common, but it is such a gem. And it's called Mouse Tales. And it's these 7 stories about mice, and they're totally wacky and quirky. And one of them is this mouse is dirty, so he needs to take a bath. So he gets into the bathtub and he turns on the water, and the water fills up the bathtub, and then it flows out and fills up his bathroom. And then it flows out the window and it fills up the neighborhood. And his neighbors yell, "Turn off the water, you're clean now." And then so he does. But I feel like this is what we're doing with plastics. Like every year we're producing 390 million metric tons and growing, and there's no drain. The drain is geology. Geology breaks down stuff, you know, like the forces of erosion break stuff down. UV light breaks plastic down, and it breaks it into really small parts that are really hard to get out of anything, and they get ingested. They affect soil microbes, soil ecology. They get into waterways. You know, there's like an estimated 10 pieces of microfibers in bottled water on average. They say you ingest up to a credit card's worth of plastic every year through these microfibers, or microplastics. You know, it's like, We are filling up the bathtub and then some, and there's no drain. What are we doing?
Right. And then we're on this spherical body that has a certain atmosphere and a certain amount of depth in the water in the soil. And our problem is that if we fill it up, there's nowhere for it to go.
Yeah.
And so there are actually, which is really interesting, some futurists have thought about, which would be energy intense, but of launching plastic into space and putting it somewhere, you know. Sticking it on a planet or, you know, or on our moon or whatever. But it's crazy. I mean, it's crazy ideas rather than looking at. So we're looking at that other end. We're saying, we aren't going to put a drain in. We're just going to figure out another way to just make the tub bigger. And that's part of the problem is that if it has nowhere to go, and you're right about it breaking down. That was interesting to me when you were talking. Because the things that you can do with plastic and can't do when you're thinking of making your fashion are the exact problems in recycling it. It is really difficult once it is something. It breaks down, but it's really difficult to reuse it as something else. Yeah, grinding it up and making it into some sort of packing, we could probably do that with like styrofoam or something, but it makes no, it is so difficult. Because each plastic, and I guess that's what you find too, each plastic is unique. Its chemistry is very different. That's why we have those numbers on them.
And actually, that's only part of it. The additives that they put in to create all of the different characteristics that are valuable in the products that they're serving are the problem. So, for example, a lot of hair, well, I guess the listeners can't see, but a lot of the colorful plastic food packaging is not recyclable because it's composite material. You know, we think of it as just plastic, but it's like up to 7 layers of material. And they just are able to fuse these together. And then it's very hard to get them separated cleanly. And likewise, I mean, you know, think about what goes into your recycling bin, all those plastic jugs. Some of them are clear, some of them are colored, some of them are white, opaque, you know, some of them are flexible, some of them are rigid. Each one of those different types of plastics has different things added to it. So it's very hard to get a clean, and that's part of the reason why the recycled products are not as desirable, because it's very challenging to get pure polyethylene back. You know, they've put all these plasticizers, which is a bad word because it has plastic, it makes it confusing, but you know, they put all these things to make it flexible or to make it more rigid or, you know, whatever, to color it. And
we use plastic beads and lubricants and hair, you know, hair shampoo. And it's really interesting, and it is different than aluminum and glass, where though they really have a market. Paper the same way, they all have a market.
And interestingly, aluminum and glass are infinitely recyclable.
Yes.
They never degrade.
No.
You just melt them up and reform
them. Go right on with them and keep using them. And so when I'm thinking about all those things that you're going to do, and I just think the idea that it's really wonderful that you're considering trying to put it somehow in a time frame, you know, beyond this show that's coming up, but creating that it's somehow in time. And I'm going to be curious to really see where you take that and how you think about it.
Yeah. And I need collaborators. So if any of your listeners are interested in collaborating with me, I have a portion on my website where you can see what I'm collecting. And then of course I'm always open to new ideas. So,
name your website for us.
Oh, it's just my name. It's calliopemonoyos.com. So, do you want me to spell it or?
No, I'll put it. No, it'll be okay. it'll be on our website with your,
if only I had a name like
taped show.
Dane Smith.
Yeah. Well, you don't want that name. This is great.
The people would never be able to find me.
They would never be able to find it. This has really been a great conversation. I want to thank you so much, Cappy, for spending time with us and talking about plastic. And I have a new understanding of it, but I also have a much better understanding of the art and how your art keeps transforming. And I think that's my last question is this idea that you as an artist are still growing and transforming. Is that part of what is so special about being an artist? Is the growth?
That's an interesting question. I mean, for sure, that's what makes life interesting, right? If we stagnate, then I don't know, snooze fest. but yeah, when I first started, I think I was afraid that I wouldn't have enough ideas. I could only, you know, I had the three ideas I had, and I thought, oh gosh, when I finish those, what am I gonna do? But the reality is that there's so many inputs in today's world, right? We're just barraged with information and new updates. And that's what I love about working at the forefront of science, is that frontier of knowledge is just captivating, and it's always pushing ahead. So, you know, I'm reading things, I'm thinking, I'm reacting, I'm learning myself. I'm on a journey to understand my relationship with plastic, which drives a lot of my art, as I discover things. And, you know, just, yeah, I think that's really the joy of it for me. And it's really rewarding too, because, you know, when you're really deeply interested in a topic, you find that they're a couple steps ahead of your friends. And that's how I feel. You know, sure, there are lots of people who know a ton more about this than I do, but there are also a lot of people who know a ton less. And so that's my audience. You know, I'm just like telling them what I'm learning, and it's really rewarding to pass on that knowledge and raise, you know, do my part to raise people's consciousness a little bit more.
That's wonderful. And the way you're ending it is just perfect. So it's the ongoing education of you and people that see your work. Thank you so much. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.